Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, Dave here with a quick production note. Today's episode will be a short one for reasons we'll explain in the episode itself. We'll be back in full force soon.
Do or do not. There is no try.
What?
That's Yoda from Star Wars.
Oh.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast. No, this is the Extra Hot Great Podcast. This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 397, the week of March 7, 2022. I am heirloom quality X-Acto knife David T. Cole, and I'm here with Steve Jobs superfan Tara Ariano.
No, it's normal.
And diabetic Walgreens shopper Eve Beatty.
You guys, this is an immersion program.
I think maybe we should just do the whole first segment in this voice.
It hurts so much.
Oh.
I can't commit to that. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week. Before we get into our episode and welcome our guest, we want to say Sarah is not with us today. She has a family emergency. Please send her good thoughts, especially our guest, who is her co-editor on the Best Evidence podcast, as well as the editor at East Bay Nosh. You've heard her on this podcast many times. Welcome back, Eve Beatty.
Eve Beatty, welcome back.
Yay!
Hey, guys.
Oh, God, gives me every time.
We are here to talk about The Dropout. And here's what you need to know. What if you didn't have to draw an entire friggin' vial of blood to test it? That's the idea that propelled Elizabeth Holmes to drop out of Stanford in her sophomore year and found her own company, Theranos, to develop a product that would permit ordinary people to test their own blood at home. Unfortunately for Elizabeth, her investors, and the human beings she used in developing this concept, what she wanted to make actually only exists in the realm of magic. But to keep Theranos afloat and herself rich, she did a bunch of shady shit and was convicted of investor fraud earlier this year. And this miniseries is her story. Series dropped its first three episodes on Hulu last week. Four more are to come on Thursdays. It was created by Liz Merriweather, best known for New Girl. And the first four episodes were directed by Michael Showalter from The State and Wet Hot American Summer. Let's do the Chen check-in. But first, before we get there, I can just add a little color to say, on the basis of the first episode, this feature's namesake, David Chen, has come out a staunch no on the show in an Instagram story that I think has gone now. His feeling was the first episode was trying to redeem Elizabeth Holmes. I can kind of see it, since his focus is on the years before she was doing crimes. But the second and third are, I would say, pretty unambiguously damning. Eve, should our listeners watch The Dropout?
If you are going to pick one of the fallible founder shows, that's The Dropout, Super Pumped, and the WeWork one.
We crashed.
Where it's Jared Leto. Yeah, thank you. Yes, yeah, so I could think it's like, Papa, I want to be a designer. If like out of those three, I would choose The Dropout first. But mm-hmm. if you don't have time and you can't watch any of them, your life is not going to be any different.
Dave?
Yeah, this kind of story, I mean, just like the real world story of it, isn't really something I care about. Ditto WeWork, ditto Uber, ditto any like Silicon Valley kind of stuff. I just find like it's just a morass. It's just a swamp of terrible people that I really don't want to engage with. But the show as watched is well put together and sometimes so preposterous that it floats over to like a little bit of giggle comedy. So I would say like it could be worth your time if you're into this type of story. It is not well put together.
I mean, having just watched the first episode of Super Pumped last week, which I talked about, and it was terrible. this one might have had more of a glow just in comparison. But I also had to do a pretty deep dive on Pam and Tommy, which is another, not quite exactly the same, but another crime show also on Hulu, also about real people. And this was, I thought, much better than that. I haven't watched We Crashed yet. Let's get into it. Eve, you live in San Francisco.
I do indeed.
Co-edit a true crime newsletter. You were following this case very closely from the start.
Eve, she has blood.
You know what? Here's the thing. I do have a blood disorder. I've gotten stuck many, many times. And I had sort of forgotten about how unpleasant phlebotomy is until in that first episode. I felt like that was one of the most realistic ways to depict phlebotomy and its unpleasantness when we saw that there. And I thought that, you know, for a second, I kind of got it. I kind of got why, you know, not Peter Cook, but the other one. God, what's that guy's name? Why everybody who, who kept sort of coming up, oh, I got stuck so many times. Oh, they've stuck me so many times. And why there was this cell of an idea. The show made me think about that and maybe why this was a good idea a lot better than the reams of things that I have read and podcasts I've listened to and everything else ever did. So that in and of itself, I think sort of makes it like worthwhile as something that exists in the world. But I spent a lot of time thinking, what's the goal here? Is this a comedy? Because we have all these comedy actors I keep expecting to be funny. Is this just a show about fat suits? You know, like, because I mean, no, Naveen Andrews isn't really like that now, is he?
No, he was interviewed for Vulture. He said he gained 25 pounds and he also wore a prosthetic.
Yeah, because sometimes it looks super weird and sometimes it didn't. Is Dave Chen correct? Is this an attempt to redeem her or explain her motivations given the context of the misogyny of Silicon Valley, all of which seemed very realistic to me? And I think I'm not alone in that. Or to, you know, bring up some of the things that were brought forth in the trial regarding her complicated relationship, you know, with Sonny Balwani or what? Like, it was one of those things that sort of like in Inventing Anna, where I'm like, so what's the story here? What are we trying to really say here? And I'm not sure I ever got an answer.
Critique that a lot of these sort of springtime of scam shows are getting is that it's too soon for us to really look back on these. I mean, especially in the case of Elizabeth, like she was just convicted in January of 2022. Like it's still an ongoing story, literally. Like, do you think it's too soon to assess her life and her story this way?
This is not intended to be like a documentary or like a faithful adaptation. We've heard from so many famous people lately who are playing true crime figures, be that Kate McKinnon in the Carol Baskin Tiger King adaptation, and even Colin Firth in The Staircase, that I'm dramatically paraphrasing. These words do not come out of their mouth, but basically like, the real story doesn't matter. I'm acting and I'm in a story and it's like anything else.
Yeah.
And so like maybe this is how the normals are intended to sort of approach this, but like Dave, you know, since I do have, you know, whatever relationship with Silicon Valley as everybody at in a certain age does, it's hard for me to look at that as like a regular person just watching TV and just view it as a story.
Yeah. Dave, you had very little knowledge of this story. Did you feel like the episodes that you watched gave you a decent grounding of like what you needed to know?
I feel like the whole thing about dismissing their take on the story after episode one is that they are setting up their character. You know, if we just imagine for a moment this character didn't exist in the real world, you know, they're setting up their character as, although sort of single-minded and to others a little bit strange, had an idea and wanted to act on it with all good intentions, plus also wanted to be very rich. You know, it is a quintessentially kind of an American story at that point. And then they set her up for the fall, which is she got greedy. She got in over her head. It became sort of this farcical compounding problem very quickly. If you walked away from the first episode thinking they're treating her too well, then maybe they should have just for those people, they should have accelerated the story a little bit to give a taste of episode two and three inside, a little bit more of that inside the first episode, because that is not the take of the series.
Yeah,
but I feel you need that in order to see the greed, the anxiety, you know, the fact that she is like a 20-something trying to run a company and she only knows how to deal with little machines and stuff like that. Obviously not a people person. Absolutely doesn't know the A to Z's of running a corporation, including legal and the FDA and all this sort of stuff. So I feel like it's showing somebody very easily getting in, very quickly getting in over their head, maybe just a little too slow in the show for Dave Chen.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the second episode too, it goes, I mean, the story from, you know, college to founding the company, you forget how short a timeline that actually is until you get to the second episode and she's pitching it to try and raise funds. And the one guy's like, wait, are you a PhD or a medical doctor? You're like, oh, yeah. Like he says, I don't understand how you're doing this with basically a high school education. And it's like, she surrounded herself with a lot of very experienced, knowledgeable people. But it's true. Like she is supposed to be the face of this company and she's a kid. I mean, she's really a kid.
But at the same time, all of these people, and I feel like this is something where the show could have given me a little bit more. Like, why were all of these people believing in her? Why was Fat Suit Mike Girl Ironsides so willing to believe her? Why was, God, Stephen Fry, that's the person who was in Peter Cookies. Why was Stephen Fry, who I do not always like. I find him frequently smug, but I like him very much here. I have a lot of affection for this character.
Yeah.
But he very elegantly communicates affection for the Lily Kane. Shit. Oh, my God. I'm so sorry. I think of that actress as Lily Kane. That was so stupid of me. Obviously, I know that Elizabeth Holmes is not Lily Kane from Veronica Mars. He elegantly sort of communicates affection for her in a way that doesn't feel too mansplainy. Mm-hmm. But why do all these people believe in her? I mean, and I'm not saying it because she doesn't have a degree. I don't have a degree either. You guys believe in me, right? Mm-hmm. But, and also like, you know, something, a big part of the Silicon Valley ethos is, yeah, you do drop out once you have your big idea and you have funding. Nobody is supposed to like stick around and get their degree. There are people who will give you money to drop out. But that is the part that confuses me. Why did everyone follow her? Why did Anna, who is a real person, why did she, you know, follow her? Why? Because especially, you know, like Anna is somebody who has seen, if you look at like Anna's resume, Anna's the designer, the woman with the very cool glasses and the jacket and all that, that she wooed away from Apple. Why did Anna, of all people who should know better, follow her? There had to be something there, but we don't get it. What we get is, you know, Elizabeth saying the same thing Vigilante just said in Peacemaker, right? Oh, I don't have normal emotions. And so it's like, listen, I'm all for sort of like normalizing narrow atypicality, right? Mm-hmm. Vigilante did a nice job of that. keep doing it. We need to keep doing that. But I don't see how, I mean, that's a problem, right? That a lot of people who are neuroatypical run into. So how did she make it work?
Yeah, there was no personal razzle-dazzle.
Yes.
You know, there's no Steve Jobsian in the room moments, even though she obviously worshipped at the altar of Steve Jobs, but she didn't have whatever that was.
Mm-hmm.
And so it had to be, if not that, then it had to be the idea of the product and the marketability of that. And that wasn't really communicated either between her and investors, between her and the people that made the company happen inside of the show. So they, personality-wise, decided that on screen she is going to be Mark Zuckerberg, right?
Yeah.
Like that part of, I don't quite know how to communicate in a group setting. I have my own sort of personal take on the world that I kind of keep to myself, and I don't really do a good job of selling my zeal for X to people in the room. So why are they doing it? Is it because the product is so amazing and it's going to be something? Is it going to be basically, you know, the equivalent of the Holy Grail of like needleless diabetes analysis or something like that? They didn't really do that in the show.
Yeah.
So yeah, you do get this sort of weird area where you're not quite sure what the magnetic force is here, and it does sell the concept short.
Yeah, I should say this is also based on a podcast of the same name, but which I didn't listen to, but I read the book by John Carreyrou, Bad Blood, that was about this. And so I feel like part of it is that you know, at this point in the mid-2000s in Silicon Valley, like, there had already been enough flameouts in media where, like, big things were promised, and that's certainly an easier thing to do a proof of concept for than this. And, you know, Facebook had, like, come and gone. Like, there's only so much you can do social media-wise. And so if you get pitched an idea like this where it's like, this is biotech, this could be the next thing, it's so exciting, we want to get in on the ground floor of this. And when someone is saying, we are trying to make, you know, healthcare accessible in this country, not by actually making it accessible to people to access it, you know, by seeing a doctor, for example. But the idea of, like, taking experts out of any process is something that I think is appealing to a certain kind of, like, libertarian Silicon Valley psycho. But as you both said, that's not something that has been made explicit yet, at least across the
industry. Right. And there's that whole discussion with Laurie Metcalf's character in the first episode about, well, you can't solve problems with just pure data.
Yeah.
Well, the Laurie Metcalf speech is basically the whole show, though, right?
Yeah.
I mean, like, the thing is, I assume that's how they convinced her to take this, like, tiny little role where, you know, it's the first time Laurie Metcalf's been on campus in Scream 2. And, because, like, that's, you know, she tells you everything that's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's slow. You're not going to want to make it slow. You're going to want to skip steps. It's going to be bad for you, and you can't mess up, because the moment you mess up, everyone's going to go after you. And that sort of is, I think, the thing that I sort of keep, I don't struggle with the case in real life. Like, I feel like I have, like, a pretty good handle on it and everything. And so, like, I'm compartmentalizing the two. But if I look at, because this is my opinion of the case. My opinion of the case is that Elizabeth Holmes told the same sort of lies that a lot of guys tell when they're trying to get money for their company. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work out because she got nailed and she lied to the wrong people, like Kissinger. And, you know, and George Shultz and, you know, and so the shit went down. But I also think that Martha Stewart, like, scammed with stocks. She did. Martha Stewart scammed with stocks. She was convicted. But do guys get caught for that? And they don't. And I feel like the show is sort of saying that, and they aren't saying it too overtly, and I appreciate that. But I do think at a certain point, and I've only watched the first three episodes, I didn't watch the remaining bits of the show yet. Mm-hmm. I am curious to see if they're going to say it that much more clearly, or if they're going to more clearly make what I believe are obvious comparisons between Elizabeth Holmes and Martha Stewart, comparisons that lots of people have made prior to me right now.
Mm-hmm. With regard to Martha, like, when you think about the senators who sold all their, you know, hotel and airline stocks after their COVID briefing in 2020 and, like, nothing happened to them, that seems way more unethical to me, for example.
Yeah.
How big a red flag about a person's character would you say extreme Steve Jobs fandom is? Because to me, it's pretty big.
Well, for me, it's the redder flag is the Larry Ellison fandom, because Larry Ellison is, I think, a legit bad guy. But I also do want to point out something. I think the casting on the show is really great. Mm-hmm. I really like how they cast throughout. And the Larry Ellison casting is something that really stopped me in my tracks, because, you know, Hart Bochner, the guy who plays Larry Ellison in this, for one thing, he's old. He's like 75 and he looks fantastic when he's there on the boat.
But
also, yeah. Well, up there, he's like 70 something. He's like old. He's old.
Jesus.
But here's the other thing. I always forget. That's the guy who played Ellis in Die Hard. That's the guy who was sitting there with Hans Gruber, mm-hmm. the sort of scammy bullshit Masters of the Universe guy. And I'm like, to me, there was this moment of sort of like symmetry and full circle when I saw that he was playing Larry Ellison and he's there on the fucking boat and everything. I'm like, yeah, it's Ellis all over again. This is like Ellis if, you know, things hadn't, spoiler alert, if he hadn't gotten killed in Die Hard.
Great. Now we have to deal with that.
Oh, shoot. You should have done a little musical thing. Sorry about that, guys.
Oops.
But I think that lots of people think that Steve Jobs is great. And I do think that there is a strong argument to be made that in many ways, Steve Jobs made the world a better place. Dave just called me on my iPhone. Mm-hmm. On my laptop right here is a Mac. I like the products. They've improved my life. They've made my life arguably worse in some ways too, but there are worse people to venerate than Steve Jobs.
Sure.
And I think that this show venerates some of them. And I feel like this is going to be a very veneration heavy episode. Okay, guys, I'm sorry about that. There's a lot of veneration. We're going to be talking a lot of veneration today.
But it was interesting because she admires Steve Jobs for what he built and how she cannot emulate Steve Jobs in the show. Like, it's a disconnect there, because, like, Steve Jobs is not the engineer. Steve Jobs is the razzle-dazzle guy who comes in and sells you in the idea that this thing is actually three things and you have to buy it. And here we go off to the races. And she has zero of those skills.
Yeah.
But she knows that she wants to be to the medical community what Apple was to computers. To see her at in lineup for iPhone number one and get caught up in the wave of hysteria, which was the cringiest thing I've seen on TV this year.
Yeah.
And because
because it was
because
accurate.
You know it's real.
Because yes. I was in one of those lines once in New York and we saw some of those people there. I'm like, dude, I'm excited because I like gadgets and I like technology and I love computers and I love things that make me do that organize my scattered brain and allow me to live in the world. But seeing the kind of guy in New York that we saw on the show, like, runs out with the bag. I'm the first guy. I love Steve Jobs. I'm like, oh, dude. Like, it just, it plays into my distrust of fandom.
Yeah.
Or not fandom, rather, but just people that identify as fans of something. Because that means something different to me. Like, when you're a fan of something, you stop being critical of it. To a certain degree.
Yeah.
And that is very cringeworthy to me, and very, and also kind of worrisome to me in a lot of ways, depending on what the subject matter is.
Yes, consuming is not a personality.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I felt the show did a really good job of selling me and just how uncomfortable that whole thing made me.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, yeah. But like, this is something that we think about, you know, we old timers look back and like, wow, people were like really sort of rabid with when they were getting that iPhone. But think about how much more rabid people are now about Elon Musk and about getting a Tesla and about all this other stuff. If anything, that that iPhone moment was, in my opinion, somewhat quaint because it's so much more fervent now, like sort of that worship of any of these people.
That's true. So back to the casting, which we've touched on a little bit. Originally, the lead role was going to be played by Kate McKinnon, who you already mentioned is in the Tiger King fictionalized miniseries on Peacock. I guess she decided to do that instead, or the timing didn't line up. Who knows? And although the show has, I think, kind of absurd comic elements that you might expect given the behind-the-camera talent, I feel like Seyfried is a better choice. Eve, what do you think?
Like, once I saw that it was starting with, you know, with Elizabeth very young, and Seyfried can definitely, like, she does have that ability to come across as very youthful. Those huge eyes certainly don't hurt, but she also has, you know, just like amazing skin and stuff too. But I'm like, how Kate McKinnon, you know, God bless her, I think comes across as her age or slightly older. And how, like, the idea of dropping Kate McKinnon in Stanford, the idea of Kate McKinnon getting mansplained to by anyone, the idea of Laurie Metcalf yelling at Kate McKinnon. I think it is really actually like sort of a blessing that McKinnon passed. I remember being sort of bummed when I like saw the headline, but this worked out the way it should have.
Yeah, I think so too. The voice. Let's talk about it. Because if the only thing that people know about Elizabeth Holmes is that she did a crime and she had this crazy fake voice.
I am just going to right now insert a clip of Pee Wee Herman from Pee Wee's Big Adventure. Mr. Herman, Mr. Herman. That's like the affectation that she brought to it. Like, it is such a, like, how do I play in the boys' room here? I guess I will talk like this now. Like, let's have a talking like this contest.
Yeah.
Imagine it's like meeting her. At first, you're like, what the fuck? And then, like, there's this weird hypnotic rhythm to it that I'm like, more, please. I don't want to be friends with you. I couldn't stand this 24/7. And, you know, like, when she first does it over the phone, it's like, you got a cold? She's like, pops out of it. But I feel like just like that, I don't know. There's something about that that I feel like if I could buy the Theranos Lady GPS system pack, I totally would.
Alexa, the Alexa voice.
Yes. We need someone to do a mashup of her voice and the
get that thing for me
voice from Dune.
Oh, the voice? Yeah. Yes. You want to give me large fries? Large fries. Large fries.
The show does a nice job of explaining how the voice potentially evolved.
Yes.
And, you know, there's that sort of side remark from Sonny early on, like, don't use your effusive, don't use your impulsive voice. Don't use your effusive voice. But I also think that, you know, there's so much sort of gendered criticism around, like, what she did with her voice, too, that, you know, I'm as guilty of as anyone. But also, anytime, and I don't know if this is See, Tara, since you're Canadian, I think, and also since you're so practiced on the mic, it's different for you. But for people like me who aren't in audio all the time, like when I do radio or something like that, inevitably I get a helpful fucking email from a guy who has some thoughts about like the one time I did up talk or my vocal fry or something else. And, you know, and I'm not even like that bad, but still every woman's voice is up for discussion the same way that her weight is. And there are so many guys who want to help us with vocal coaching that I get it. Like with, once again, we're talking about within this story. We're not talking about real life, but within this story, I get it because I do know how hard people are on women and their voices and their speech.
Yeah.
And if anyone comes to me about this podcast and my voice, now you know how I feel. When I say thanks, I'll take it under advisement. That means fuck you.
Thanks for your comments. Keep reading, dash, dash. That was our kiss off line. Let's talk about the rest of the casting. We've already mentioned Stephen Fry as Ian Gibbons and Laurie Metcalf as Dr. Phyllis Gardner, the one person in this whole thing who sees through Elizabeth. Let's talk about Naveen Andrews as Sonny, who in that interview that I mentioned earlier, and we'll link to it in the show notes, he says when this came to him, he thought of that character as kind of a Lady Macbeth, which I thought was a really interesting take. How did you think he did?
Well, now that you've said that, that makes the moment where he sort of stalks around the lab saying, oh, I'm just taking a look, that is so crystal clear. I mean, I will say that when I first saw him in the show, I turned to Tim, to my husband, you guys know Tim, and I said to him, I know this person, but they're different in real life. And Tim's like, I know them too. And we're just staring it down. You know, we're resisting looking at IMDb. And I said, surely that is not the guy from Lost with bad hair and a fat suit. And Tim's like, he's not fat. I look like that. And I'm like, you don't look like that. And then it turned into a whole thing. But sure enough, like it's.
Did Tim go to the kitchen and eat his feelings?
No, I told Tim, you know what? If you don't want to be fat, drink this fucking green juice, bitch. Once again, I'm not clear on, like, I know who this real person is. I know how he has his money and everything. There are these moments where I am, like, interested and I want to know, like, a little bit more, like, when he's, you know, going through, I guess it's customs, you know, and his stuff's being searched, or he says the stuff about, like, when you're driving a Lamborghini, no one thinks you're a terrorist. And I don't need, like, a whole story on this guy, but it's just, like, is he someone who just happened to have money and he was sort of farting around in Palo Alto? And then he's like, hey, maybe I'll go back to school. Like, what's this guy's deal?
Yeah.
Was he really and truly just a hanger-on controller guy? Because sure, that's what, you know, Elizabeth said in court during the trial, which went down, I assume, after production wrapped on this. But is that true? We won't really know the answer to that until Sonny goes on trial. And I want to just sort of mention an interesting sort of side note with all this. So the reason that Elizabeth hasn't been sentenced yet is because even though she ended up sort of taking a deal, the deal is contingent on the outcome of Sonny's criminal prosecution. So typically what that means is that she's like really making a deal and, you know, it's like successful prosecution, you know, means A and, you know, unsuccessful prosecution means B. But so we're going to get this whole other story when Sonny's trial comes out. And
right.
So I just sort of wonder why they didn't wait, you know, to your earlier point. Why didn't they wait?
Yeah. I will say that interview says, like, they had already started shooting when the texts between Elizabeth and Sonny were entered into the record in court. So they sort of felt like, oh, okay, this justifies a lot of the choices that we made in portraying these two characters. Like, it seemed to... Critics like our past guest, Caroline Framke, have pointed to the comedy as an element that sets us apart from the other scam titles. We've talked about that a little bit. I mean, the moment where they put in the tester card and the machine starts oozing blood, it was like, okay, this is an absurdist kind of a thing. I mean, I wouldn't say it's hilarious, but there are definitely some slapsticky moments, like when Don Lucas makes his impromptu visit to the lab and Elizabeth has to like try and stall him while they're trying to put something together that they can show him. And then Rakesh gets an entire tray of blood samples like busted all over his shirt. I mean, it's not hilarious, but it is funny to me. Did you find it funny, Eve?
Well, I found it sort of like, you know, dark comedy. Like I do feel like it had a lot of like sort of shared DNA with Inventing Anna, in that there is that sort of like, it's funny and it is... like, it's weird, like, almost, like, British.
Yeah.
Like, Like, you're not sure, am I supposed to be laughing or not? And so, like, I saw that, but I do think that a lot of times the casting also set us up for, like, an expectation that isn't fulfilled. Like, this is a funny person. This guy is naturally funny. I'm expecting mm-hmm. him to be funny. I'm waiting for the joke to drop. It doesn't drop. Like, how do I feel?
Right. Well, that's The Dropout. I mean, it seemed like we got a lot out of it in that one little finger prick of
a joke. Did you guys watch the rest of it?
No.
Are you going to?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm going to keep watching.
Yep.
It is time to go around the dial. First up,
First, my highbrow title of the week, Our Flag Means Death. Taika Waititi has already brought us a spectacular TV comedy, What We Do in the Shadows. He's also an EP on Reservation Dogs, although he did not create that one. So when you heard that he had cast Rhys Darby from Flight of the Conchords as a pirate captain in a sitcom set in pirate times, you might have gotten really excited. I did. Our Flag Means Death is fine. The first three episodes dropped on HBO Max last week. That's all I've seen. And the premise of the show is that Steed Bonnet, who's played by Darby, is trying to be a different kind of pirate captain. The men get a salary, whether they plunder or not. He's given them a jam room below decks. He's brought his entire library with him and made it available, even though only one guy can actually read, which is also why Captain Bonnet reads them a chapter of Pinocchio every night at bedtime. The problem is, he has a real aversion to the actual piracy parts of pirate life, but his crew do not, which is why, spoiler, the first episode revolves around a possible mutiny. He's planning to take down another ship to boost morale, but then it turns out to be a British naval ship captained by a guy who knew Bonnet at boarding school and who also lets the audience know that Bonnet was a regular, boring nobleman with a wife and kids who ignored him at best and hated him at worst before he spontaneously left them for piracy. And there are a few funny bits in each episode that sort of hint at what the show could be if it just relaxed. But for me, this is an uneasy middle ground between the Taika Waititi of What We Do in the Shadows and the Taika Waititi of Jojo Rabbit, which I was very ambivalent about. The flashbacks to Bonnet's earlier years are supposed to show us why he was unsatisfied with the life he was born into and why he's kind of wimpy now, but they stop the action dead. They don't really tell us anything we actually need to know for this to be a funny show. Like, a pirate captain who's timid and hates violence but is still trying to make it work? Got it! Let's go! But the other issue is that if you're used to the rhythms of What We Do in the Shadows, this is so slow. It has a core cast of that show has a core cast of five and a jokes per minute rate that is off the charts. This has probably more than a dozen named characters in the pirate crew alone, and giving them all something to do feels laborious. It's such a dumb, silly premise. It should feel lighter and faster than it is. I will keep watching because I think it has potential to tighten up, but go into it knowing it's more of a dramatic character study than a hard sitcom. Dave, you also watched it.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's so hard to like pin down where it is on the spectrum because like I hesitate to even say it like it has dramatic elements to it because like even the drama, you can tell it's trying to be couched in comedy.
Yeah.
You know, like there's brackets around here and this order of operations puzzle that is Our Flag Means Death. But, like, it really is. Like, knowing the DNA of the show, why am I not laughing more? Why am I not more amused by everything? And it just, there's a certain flatness to the whole production. I feel like it's stringing me up. Eventually, I will give up on this show. Everybody is involved. I've enjoyed the past project so much that I feel like, is there something wrong with me? Am I not getting it? Am I my standards too high? Like, I'm doing that weird sort of bargaining. It's simply okay.
No, it's the children who are wrong, which is a bummer. But, you know, as Dave said, because of the people involved, I'll give it more of a chance, probably. My lowbrow pick this week is The Courtship. Here's the latest twist on The Bachelorette. What if all the dudes vaguely pretended they were in Jane Austen times and the lady kind of didn't really bother? That's the premise of NBC's The Courtship. Software engineer, former Seattle Seahawks cheerleader Nicole Remy arrives at a castle in England, maybe, impossible to tell, along with her court, her parents, her sister, and her best friend to do early 19th century things with a bunch of dudes in period costume. At least based on the first episode, she just wears regular gowns, like maybe more of a fuller skirt than you'd see on a bachelorette. The host, some British guy, just wears a suit that looks like it's from circa Downton Abbey. So already, adherence to the conceit, loose at best. All the guys introduce themselves to Miss Remy initially by letter, and the host tells us that they all went to calligraphy classes for this, but the edit shows us their letters. They generally look like they're the work of second graders learning cursive. The most successful guy at this stage seems to be the one who soaked his letter in cologne to be like, smell me when we get to the ball, and it works. Then the guys all arrive at the castle by horseback or carriage for a ball where Miss Remy's court will vet the guys, and then she will come out for the usual cocktail party. Can I steal you for a second, baloney? Speaking of that, the chilling thing about this show and others like it, like The New Joe Millionaire, which I talked about a couple months ago, is realizing as you watch, there's a whole generation of people who learned the norms and lexicon of dating from dating reality shows, here for the right reasons, out of my comfort zone, with that being said, when nothing has been said, etc. One of the guys at his arrival gets asked what he's hoping for, and he speeches that he wants an adventure like I've never known before, like be normal. The other strange thing about the show is that you would think they would cast a heroine who is evidently really into the works of Jane Austen. Like, I've read all the books. I read them when I was a kid. I love the time period. But, like, the show opens with a butchering of the "it is a truth universally acknowledged" line from the beginning of Pride and Prejudice. So they are explicitly referencing her a lot. But Miss Remy, though she is very pretty and apparently accomplished, does not really seem to care that much about all this. She says like 20 times in her introductory speech to her suitors, not to police her language. I'm just saying she's trying to be a Jane Austen heroine. She's not. And she mutters to one of them, we're in a Jane Austen movie, which yes, but no. The other thing the courtship wants to remind you of is Bridgerton. There is a farewell dance scored to a chamber music arrangement of Fade Into You. But unlike Jane Austen's oeuvre, Bridgerton is not in the public domain, so they don't mention that. Also, the castle exterior is real, but either the interior set is on a soundstage or they only got permission to shoot in a corner of one ballroom because it looks terrible. She cuts some guys. The biggest drama of the night is that the last guy she cuts tells her he thinks she's making a mistake and everyone gasps, but then he just leaves and like doesn't make a scene. So whatever. This is overwrought. It's really only for people who need bachelor methadone with that season ending soon. And instead, I will say, get excited for Fire Island, a feature film, gay reimagining of Pride and Prejudice written by Joel Kim Booster, who did read and love the book. It is coming to Hulu this spring. The courtship. Wow. What a waste of time.
You know those children's books that have like three panels and you choose like this got the head of a rhinoceros and, you know, the body of a cat and the yes. ass of a monkey. Like
yes.
that is where we're at with these mm-hmm. shows now. It's like it's got to be Bachelor, but yes. it's got to be, what are we going to do to this? I guess it's Bachelor's with a monkey's ass. Let's go.
Yeah. I mean, I talked about Love is Blind last week. Like all of the kinetic content shows have really like upped the ante of how to make a dating show insane. And so if you're not going to like even reach for that, don't bother, because the bar is now here in terms of cuckoo-ness. For my plug, guys, I interviewed John Hamm for GQ. Wow. He has a new true crime podcast called American Hostage, which is loosely the peg for the story. But I also asked him about his dog. So if that's something that interests you, and it is, you can check that out at GQ.com. And we will link that in the show notes.
Eve, what do you have for us?
Well, listen, I'm not a big fan of talk shows, especially the late night ones. That whole sort of like canned anecdote, and I'm, hey guys, here's the clip from my show. Like, I don't give a shit about that. It feels awkward and makes me uncomfortable. So I don't watch Late Night with Seth Meyers, but I do watch a late night spinoff property that's only on YouTube. It's called Corrections. The whole Corrections little segment started about a year ago. There's a Vanity Fair article about how it started. I'll give it to you guys to put in the notes or whatever you do. So Meyer started doing this YouTube only response to people who comment on the late night YouTube videos, which why you're reading YouTube comments just shows that Seth Meyers is new, but whatever. But so it's something that they tape on Thursday night. It's the last thing they do. The crew wants to go home. So there's something like super fucked up about that. It's like calling a meeting at 4:30 on a Friday. But anyway, that's what Seth Meyers does. So now you know who you're working for if you get a job there. And it's something that he writes on his own. And it's just responses to comments that I, as a person who's been dealing with internet comments for 18 years, think of as helpful fucking suggestions. So, you know, it's like, hey, you just wanted to let you know that a shooting wasn't in the Tenderloin. It was in Lower Pacific Heights. Fuck you. I think that Myers does say fuck you to some of his commenters too, but it's done with in a really unusual and interesting way, a way that feels light and funny, and it doesn't feel sour the way that my responses typically are, as you might have noticed, and also not, you know, that clever. I'm not the only person who enjoys comments, which suggests that corrections is maybe something that appeals to people besides people who've written for the internet for like two decades. The series was nominated for an Emmy in 2021, but lost to James Corden's inarguably despicable Carpool Karaoke.
Boo!
I know, right? Yucko. So I urge you to click around on YouTube until you find corrections. It's loose and it's messy, and it's so weird that I wonder if NBC, which I believe is owned by Comcast, even knows that its workers are doing it on the clock. Corrections.
Nice.
Check it out. Yeah. So for my plug, I am the editor of East Bay Nosh, which is a food website that covers the East Bay area. So if you're looking for places to eat in the East Bay, come check it out. It's at berkeleyside.org/nosh. Believe me, I've tried to get a better URL. I've tried and I failed. I am also the co-editor of Best Evidence, the true crime newsletter with Sarah D. Bunting. We're at bestevidence.fyi. If you're not already a subscriber, you're probably not listening to this podcast. And finally, I'll just say I also own a store in San Francisco. It's called Avenues Dry Goods. I always love it when you all stop by. So come by anytime. We're open Thursdays through Sundays, noon to five.
We'll link that as well.
Thank you.
Two shows to talk about. First is the Viking sequel that just went up on Netflix recently, Vikings Valhalla. It's now 100 years after all the stuff you watch in the first one. All those dudes are dead. They're dead. Not about them. Not about their family. Loosely tied to the city they were all in. Beyond that, it is the same show, just slightly more English content because now they're all mad at England because they killed a whole bunch of Vikings. And that's the show. It's fine. If you like Vikings, guys, more Vikings for you.
Yeah.
Lots of pretty Vikings, lots of handsome Vikings. There is a Viking lead, plays Leif Erikson, who looks like Jerry O'Connell mashed up with
Josh Hartnett.
Yeah, Josh Hartnett. Like, it is weird. Like, they definitely had a magic baby, and he is definitely the lead of this show. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got your juicy stabbings and beheadings. You've got your sex scenes. You've got lots of things lit by torchlight. Vikings, but now different Vikings. It's really the same fucking thing. So if you like Vikings, absolutely check it out. I'm watching it. It's good. I'm enjoying it. Mm-hmm. It is not going to win any prestigious awards, but that is not why we are watching.
Yes. And don't be scared that it's going to be all subtitled in various Scandinavian languages. They just are speaking English with accents.
And now it is time for...
The stars at night are big and bright.
So this week's 911 Lone Star, once again, I don't know, they're just giving up on crazy, I guess. Like, there are crazy, hear me out.
Okay.
There are crazy setups to some of these things, but they don't really pay off in the way that things have in the past. You know, we all love the volcano mini golf episode and things like that. This one opening was pretty good. I enjoyed this setup in which a soldier is now back stateside and he's surprising his wife with a FaceTime call that she's taking in the car with the baby in the backseat that he's never met.
While she's driving.
And she's all excited. It's like, say hello to daddy, moving around, not looking at the road. And then she runs him over. And that's the best part of it. And the rest of the rescue is just like, well, we need to like lift the car and lube up his leg to slip it out of the transmission he's caught in or something like that.
He seems like he's going to die. And then the baby says, dada, and that revives him and everything's fine.
And there's the thing with a parrot. It just, guys, I just like, what happened to the crazy? What happened to the absurd, crazy stuff? Like, were they worried that people would think, you know what? That many like otherworldly, weird, crazy things don't happen on a daily basis in Austin. But like, the first chunk of this show had exploding bull semen cannon fire. It had volcanoes in mini golfs. It had people that like just fell into like frat party lava pools and you just never saw them again.
Yeah.
Where is that show?
Yeah.
I always said I wasn't going to give up on this. Mark Lazanti's like, no, you got to give it. You got to do it so that people can know when it's back to form. Is it going to get back to form?
Yeah.
I'm starting to think maybe it's not.
I just want to note, this episode was the lead into the mid-season finale, and that cliffhanger was not it. I won't say what it is for people who haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but when we ended it, I literally went, that's the end? Like, I was just absolutely shocked at how underwhelming it was.
Yep. So we're not going to hear the clip about Texas. It's been so long. I don't even think people know what I'm talking about anymore.
That's what you get.
All right. On the next Extra, Extra Hot Great coming to you this Friday, we are joined by Eve to talk about Muppdates. And that is going to be a TV show. This is something that happened on social media, apparently. We are going to take a show, replace all but one of the characters with Muppets. And we're going to explain why we made all those choices. And then right here at the next EHG Prime, it is Domino Masters. From the network that brought you Lego Masters.
That's right.
And Tinker Toy Masters. And I don't know what's happening anymore, but I'm kind of weirdly excited to watch one and only one episode of the show, as I do with all these shows. We welcome back Brittany Luce to talk about Domino Masters. Check that out next week.
Extra credit topic is, what's your middle name? It comes to us from Caroline Corinne LaFlock, aka Mademoiselle Caroline, who writes, we all know the T in David T. Cole stands for Tiberius, but I wonder about the D in Sarah D. Bunting. In my head, it's Dorothy, because that would be a lovely connection to B. Arthur. I'm asking you to pick a TV character you like and invent their middle names. Explain your thought process. I'll go first. Like is a strong word. I'll say this is a character I enjoy. It is Judy Gemstone from The Righteous Gemstones. Unlike Catholics, who traditionally have biblical names, that may not have been a concern for Eli and Amy Lee, since the latter had a secular name. We know from season one flashback episode Interlude that Judy was born in 1979. And since they went hard biblical with her first name, they might have wanted to have more fun with her middle name. Amy Lee was feminine, but perhaps only relative to her brother, fairly classy. So it's not going to be something like Crystal or Amber, although those were popular names in the 70s, particularly not with the surname Gemstone. I supposed they would go with an A name to tie in with her mom. And I went with Angelina, because Eli and Amy Lee thought or hoped their daughter would be their little angel and not the nasty jerk that she actually grew up to be. Eve.
So in the grand tradition of Italian divas, Brooklyn Nine-Nine's Regina, air quotes, Gina Linetti, doesn't just have one middle name. She has a couple. Mm-hmm. Like the top Italian dog herself. I'm going to say that Gina's full name is Gina Louise Veronica Linetti. And if you don't know who I'm alluding to here, I suggest you go watch Blonde Ambition now, because it really, really holds up.
I love that.
David?
All right, my choice is Malcolm Tucker from The Thick of It. I believe his middle name is Marion, like John Wayne's first name was. And this is sort of like the origin story of Malcolm Tucker as explained through his middle name. So his parents gave him that middle name, Marion. Somehow word got out at the school when he was a kid during his formative years, and he was teased and picked on. And the other part of the story is that his parents somehow got him into a fancy school beyond their means, you know, through methods, you know, whatever the British equivalent is moving right next to Beverly Hills. So you get like the kid into the Beverly Hills school, whatever the equivalent is that they managed to do that. So he was getting picked on by all the rich kids, all the conservative family, snooty kids. And this is what formed him into the first strike biggest asshole in the liberal political arsenal in the UK. Mm-hmm. So it's all because of his middle name, and his middle name was Marion.
I love it.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is now time for our last segment, because there's no game time because of our missing host. It is time for winner and loser of the week. Eve has this week's winner.
So this week's winner is the crew of Nailed It. The crew went on strike earlier this month as they attempted to secure a contract as part of a unionization effort with IATSE. That's the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees. As opposed to bargaining, the production company, Magical Elves, that's right, it's the same people behind Top Chef.
What?
And they are Yeah, I know. Shocker. And they're also the producers of the original version of Project Runway, but not what we got now. Mm-hmm. So they're a company hardly known for amplifying messages of equity and non-toxicity. They shut the whole production down in the middle of filming the 8-episode Halloween arc of Nailed, its 7th season. According to an anonymous source who spoke to Deadline, they'd rather shut down than sign a union contract, saying that Magical Elves is notoriously non-union. Well, we're all notoriously pro-union over here, so excellent work, our Nailed It comrades. Over here, WGA East, strikes work.
Go West. Get yours.
And loser of the week, Tara?
Oh, so sad. Fox has canceled The Big Leap after one season. I talked about it on the show. Heather talked about it. It was a lovely, very silly, very unrealistic show about the goings-on behind the scenes at a dance reality show, and we got all we're going to get, and I'm heartbroken.
Speaking about being heartbroken, do you know what time it isn't? It isn't game time.
Not game time.
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We rolled up our sleeves for a 3-episode trial of The Dropout before going around the dial with stops at Our Flag Means Death, The Courtship, Corrections, Vikings Valhalla, and 911 Lone Star. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Game Time will return next week. Next up, Muppet Takeovers on Extra Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it's Domino Masters. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariana,
I can't feel my fingers,
the absent Sarity Bunting, and E. Beatty.
Hey guys, I made you a bunch of Corona sauce. Where do you want it?
I meant to ask, what's Corona sauce? I didn't
know. Made of Corona beer.
Ugh. All right, guys, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Okay, I'm gonna go now. My husband's waiting for me with a glass of red wine and a foot massage and the DVD of My Big Fat Greek Wedding, which came in the mail today. So I suggest you find a version of that for yourself.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know that many products for pregnant women do not have their own clinical trials for safety or efficacy? That's because pregnant women are often excluded from clinical studies. Ritual is aiming to set a new standard with their essential prenatal multivitamin. It's the number one best-selling prenatal and the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Moms taking Essential Prenatal had a lower overall cortisol level during pregnancy than those taking a leading prenatal. Plus, it's designed to be gentle on the stomach. Ritual doesn't just have your back. They have the receipts. Get 25% off at ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own. Surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.